Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hey, hello, welcome back to the show. Hey, Dad, how you doing?
Hello, Tay, doing good. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. How was your New Year's?
The New Year's was great. We survived it.
Well, all right.
Made it to 2023. Who would have ever thunk it?
Who knew? Anymore. These last few years, it's like just, you know, setting goals or plans. It's like, nope, we just survived. That's good.
Yeah.
Just keep on trucking.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you what, you don't make the phrase anymore. It can't be any worse than last year.
No, I'm knocking on wood right now just because you said it.
Somebody kicks your ass and shows you, oh yeah, it can be.
It can always be worse.
Yeah.
It can always be worse. But it can always be better too. Did you have anything good to drink?
Well, I'd have to go to our New Year's Eve night. We went out to one of those things where you pay one price per person and they serve you a meal and bring you drinks and stuff like that.
Nice.
Me and Mom and Riley, and I had an espresso martini there. I had I actually had two espresso martinis, and then I had a Christmas ale that they had, a brown ale with spices in it that was pretty good.
Nice.
And but the main thing that we made for when we got back home was I had done the icebox version of the espresso martini.
Oh, that's very popular. I see a lot of those on the TikToks.
Yeah, Riley had shown me the video, and I was looking at our bottle of vodka, and you have to take some out of the bottle so you can add the other ingredients in, and I thought, that bottle's at just about the right height. So we poured it out and measured how many ounces so that then we'd know how many ounces of Kahlua and espresso to add to it. So we did that and mixed it all in that vodka bottle and shook it all up. And then we had a whole damn vodka bottle full of espresso martinis to last.
That's smart. That's nice.
Yeah, it's nice. It's so convenient. Now, what we did something a little bit different. They said use espresso powder. And then just add a couple of teaspoons of water for the dilution for the other. And you're supposed to keep it in your freezer. Well, we didn't want to put it in the freezer, and we wanted to use real espresso. So we kept it in the refrigerator. And each time when I poured one, I'd shake the bottle. But then I poured it in a shaker and shook it with ice and strained it out in the glass. And it was a lot better that way. It would get re-frothy and everything.
That makes sense. Because you get the oils when you extract espresso. They're going to stay there, and they're going to create some crema every time you shake it.
Yeah, so we did it that way. But it's not a big deal. You don't have to do all the mixing. You just pour it in over the ice in the cup, shake it up, and pour it in the glass, and it's ready to go.
That's a trend. I've seen a few of those as, what do they call them, like fridge door cocktails?
Yeah, or something like cocktails. Freezer door or ice box or something. Yeah.
It's a little trickier when you have things like espresso that can degrade over time. But when you're dealing with all booze, like a martini or a Negroni or something like that, you can absolutely put three boozes in a bottle and, you know, mix them in the correct proportions and put them in your fridge or your freezer, and that's just ready to go. There's no downgrade there.
Well, I wasn't worried about degrading because we had two of us ready to drink them, so they were not going to last long enough to degrade.
That's fair.
They were degrading us, but they weren't degrading themselves.
Yes. Good for you. I did not have quite as festive a New Year just because I was on a double. It was busy. Served a lot of drunk people. French fries, but I did bring a little half bottle of like proper champagne to have for me.
Well, good.
Just hid it away in a fridge, and at midnight I just gave myself a little glass and I took the rest home.
You could have brought some of those 99 little bottles with you.
I'm a little superstitious about the new year, you know, like how, what you do on the first day of the year, what you do at midnight's going to predict your year.
Yeah.
I don't know if I think at my big age, I'm not ready for a year dictated by 99 bananas. I don't think I could survive that year.
Well, I hope you weren't taking out the garbage at midnight again this year.
No. Dad's referencing something that I felt was, there were a lot of food service. I've worked New Year's almost my entire adult life. That's just, it happens, you know, especially if you ask off for Christmas, you're working New Year's and you're working Halloween and you're working Thanksgiving. It just happened several years in a row where it would be New Year's and there would be, it would be right at midnight. There'd be a full trash can that I had to deal with. And I just felt like this just sets every year off on the wrong foot. I'm just taking out other people's trash.
I'm taking out the trash all year long.
No, I also brought my 12 grapes in a bag. Yeah. So when I snuck away with my nice little glass of real champagne, I also had my 12 grapes and I threw 12 grapes in my mouth and chased them with nice champagne. I was like, okay, no one's getting me this year. Knock on wood. Again, maybe you are. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Don't come for me.
All right. Well, I'm glad you had your 12 grapes.
I did. But all right, we're in a new year. I thought about something for this week, partially because it is a non-alcoholic ingredient. And, you know, for those of you doing dry January, no alcohol January, or those of you who don't drink, we're going to talk a little bit about a cocktail here, but there's also an ingredient that is non-alcoholic that will be the focus, and that is Rose's sweetened lime juice.
Yeah, and we have it. We've had it for a while, and I didn't even know, you know, really what was behind it. I just thought it was just another one of those sugary lime juices.
Well, it's a bit of an anomaly because I feel like when I see Rose's sweetened lime in like a nice bar, in a high end bar, I think I'm in a good place. Like they understand things on the same level that I like to have drinks made. Like that's a good sign for me when I see it in a bar. But you also see it in most dive bars. It's, you know, and it is like most people that have encountered it, it's in a grocery store because it's widely distributed. It's in a grocery store, you know, it's you can get a bottle of Rose's at Walmart. It's like $4 a bottle. If you look on the label, it's lime, corn syrup, some like preservatives like sodium metabis sulfites, you know, like it doesn't sound like a luxury product.
Blue color 12 or something like that.
It has some coloring in it, yes. It is, I think, well, it's usually right next to like Rose's Grenadine, which as we talked about like when we did a Grenadine episode, like that Rose's Grenadine is a little far removed from what good Grenadine is and what good Grenadine should be. Mm-hmm. But Rose's Lime is actually a very historically interesting product, and I'd argue a good bottle to have for a proper stocked bar, no matter how fancy you are.
Mm-hmm. I would agree after reading about it. I would not have known that before. I just thought it was another sugary substance.
Well, so to get into the history of it, the sort of the seeds of what eventually would grow into Rose's Lime, they date all the way back to at least 1753, and that's when a Scottish physician and famed naval doctor by the name of James Lind made the connection between consuming citrus and avoiding scurvy on the high seas, which is, of course, a disease caused by a vitamin C deficiency that caused the death of some 2 million sailors during the Age of Exploration. So big problem for people on long overseas trips. And I will say throughout the 17th century, there were other doctors, sailors, just people that had kind of made this connection between citrus and scurvy prevention. But Lind was the first one to have a formal clinical trial that gave some hard proof to the idea that, like, this is an effective treatment for scurvy. This is where it comes from. It's worth noting that this study that took place in, like, you know, 1753, it took another 50 years to fully understand and implement into, like, the British Navy. Because there was a lot of back and forth. Like, Lind thought that maybe, oh, we can boil down the citrus juice to reduce it and make it easy to carry. And that destroyed the vitamin C. And then there were other things he tested, like, you know, like wort and ale that also, like, they just anecdotally, this whole naval voyage took place and nobody got scurvy and they were just drinking beer. So like, oh, it must be that. So there's, you know, not perfect science happening for about 50 years. But by the 1800s, we'd figured it out. Like, okay, citrus defeats scurvy. All British naval vessels need to have citrus on board.
So the question was, how do we provide citrus on board? They're gone for long times. Fruit doesn't last that long. What do we do?
Well, and of course, the first thing, because we're already, like, at this time, we're talking in the time period where, like, you know, the British Navy were given rum rations. They were given alcohol rations. Mm-hmm. So, and you could preserve the citrus juice with alcohol very easily. Like a 15% amount of rum cut with the citrus juice. At first, it was lemons. Lemons were kind of the original one that they would send overseas. But after our main source of lemons was Spain, and then Spain allied with France, so the British Navy had to find another source for citrus, and that led them to the West Indies for limes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so for a while it was limes preserved with alcohol was the ration that was given, and this is kind of, you know, we've talked many, I think, one of our early episodes, we talked about grog, which was a mix of lime and alcohol and sugar. And this was just sort of how you made people drink it, because it made it palatable, it preserved it for long voyages, and you also got to control the alcohol concentration that you were serving people.
Which are important things when you have armed sailors.
Yes. Not, I mean, yes, but it wasn't. I mean, it took us a while to actually get a non-drunk Navy. Like that. It's like none of this time. Like the people having access to alcohol, that really didn't go away until the modern era. Like rum rations, gin rations, alcohol rations in the U.S., the British Navy, really, you know, armed forces around the world. That was in World War I, and really even in World War II. It's really up to modern times that starts getting phased out. But it did, you know, this switch from lemons to limes, it associated specifically with the British Navy, gave rise to a perhaps derogatory nickname for British people that you might hear now and then today.
Yeah, all the other sailors would call them limeys. That's how they identified the British sailors, was they called them limeys. Oh. Because of their rations of limes that they had to partake in each day.
Yeah. It took a while, you know, this at the time, fortifying lime juice with alcohol, that sort of limited its use because it was great as a ration. It was great on the high seas. But there was a Scottish ship chandler, which is just someone who provides goods to ship crews, who was named Lachlan Rose. And this was in 1865, who had the bright idea of, like, if we could preserve lime juice without the alcohol, it would be more useful to the Navy, because then they could more tightly control the amount of alcohol they're giving their sailors. But also it would open up to a wider audience that might not want booze with their lime juice. And so he had the bright idea to fortify it with sugar instead, make it more of a universally useful product.
And it worked.
Yeah. It was a success. He opened L. Rose & Co., his first lime preserving factory in 1868 in Leith, Scotland, and to secure his production line, he also went a few years later purchased lime growing land in the West Indies. Limes, of course, didn't grow in the UK, so he wanted to make sure. And where his port was, he really was kind of at a perfect place for both servicing the Royal Navy and also importing limes. So he just kind of had a perfect setup for business. I got all the limes, I've got needy customers, and a growing market for non-alcoholic preserved lime juice.
And then when his business started to take off and really grow, he needed more limes. So he also went down and got property in Africa. Mm-hmm. And started importing limes in from Africa as well.
Well, and it grew to such a point, like by 1875, he switched up. Well, I say he, at this point, that the company changed hands quite a lot, but Rose & Co. opened up a headquarters in London, and at the London docks, and they stayed there until the 1940s, where they had to temporarily vacate and relocate because these London docks were a key target to the Germans in World War II.
Yeah, they did keep their production facility still in, you know, in Scotland where they started out, but they moved their headquarters there to London. But yeah, they had to move away from the docks, with that being a prime bombing target of the Nazis every night.
Yeah. But they survived the wars, and the company went on to change hands a few times in the modern era. Schweppes had it a while. You know, they make the ginger ale. Mott's had it. Cadbury merged with Schweppes and had it for a while. It at some point it began being domestically produced in the U.S. I think it's currently under the Keurig Dr. Pepper company. All these corporate mergers and handoffs are just very strange to me. But that domestication of roses is a significant change, at least for those of us in the States, because as it happens a lot, when something becomes made on American soil, the sugar goes away and gets replaced by corn syrup. So currently, the roses you can buy in America is made with corn syrup, but if you get it in Canada or the UK, it is closer to that original recipe. It's made with real sugar.
I don't understand why we have to use corn syrup and everything. God made sugar. He didn't make corn syrup.
Well, I mean, we're not getting into a theological debate here, but I think the corn lobbies in America have a lot to do with it. And I would recommend if you're a fan of Rose of Sweet and Lime, you can very easily get bottles of the real stuff. It's like Mexican Coke. Like, you know, like Mexican Coke is the Coke made with real sugar. If you know where to get it, you seek it out, and it's so much better than Coke made with high fructose corn syrup. You can get Rose's Lime. It's usually called Rose's Lime Cordial, I think is the international name. But you can find it. It's out there on the internet. You can import it. It's better.
They called it a cordial when they first made it, a lime cordial, but it was just basically a preserved lime juice.
Well, and that is like a cordial is a cocktail term, usually referring to some sort of fruit juice preserved with sugar and sometimes alcohol as well, but that's kind of what a cordial reference is. You're usually cutting juice with enough sugar to preserve it. You know, it's like we were talking about, like with like creme liqueurs, you get a sugar concentration high enough and it's shelf stable. That's the same idea with a cordial. You just put enough sugar into something and it's shelf stable for a while. The Rose's Preserved Lime, Rose's Sweetened Lime, Rose's Lime Cordial, these are all terms that's been referred to through the years, but it's all the same concept. But this gets us into why do I think roses should be in a well-stocked bar? I mean, because, you know, as we mentioned, it's lime and sugar, more or less. So if you have those, especially in this our modern cocktail revival, if you have those things on hand, can't you just mix it up fresh, you know, like a little gin, a little lime juice, a little simple syrup? That's a gimlet, right?
But there's a reason why this lime concoction is so famous. It must do something good. That's why we need it.
Well, I think it's tied to the origin of the gimlet itself, which, you know, it's a popular cocktail. It's a go-to drink. And if you order it, I would say it's kind of a 50-50 split. If you order it in a well-stocked bar, you are just as likely to get something shaken fresh with lime juice and sugar and gin than you are to get something with Rose's Lime. And this is sort of a disconnect. This is where we're kind of almost in the desire to honor, like, historical bartending culture, we're kind of erasing bartending culture. And that's because the drink, the gimlet, which is the one most commonly associated with Rose's Lime, it is inherent to Rose's Lime. Like, that they were, it the gimlet was created with Rose's Lime in mind.
Hand in hand, they were birthed.
Yeah. So a bit of the history of the gimlet. It was first mentioned in print in, like, the 1920s. It was just gin and a spot of lime. The exact origin and creation of the drink is a little up for debate. One story contributes it to the British Navy. There was a rear admiral named Sir Thomas Desmond Gimlet, who was active service until 1913, and he sort of acted as the doctor to his crew. And, you know, so the story goes, he made sure everybody had their citrus, their Rose's Lime with their spirits, and that's why the gimlet became sort of named after him. It's a little up for debate, just because, well, what the ration used of the British Navy kind of differed over time, and also just, you know, ship to ship. It could have been gin in some places. Rum was more popular at the time, but it could have been gin. So it's, you know, we more commonly associate British rations at the time with rum, but it could have been gin. But there's also another possible origin story, which is that there is a tool that would have been used on a lot of boats and was very popular at the time, which was called a gimlet. And it's like a little piercing tool used to like bore into barrels. And it kind of both its references. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, the origin of the drink, the screwdriver. Like we'd stir the screwdriver. This little tool would have been used to pierce the barrels of rations of, you know, whatever rum, gin, grog, whatever you happen to have on board. But it also references the drink itself was very sharp and piercing and strong. So,
well, also, I think two things. I think it's funny that, so they develop a lime juice. You don't have to have alcohol to, you know, preserve it. You're using sugar. But now you're not, your sailors aren't drinking it as heartily. So what you do is you have gin and you say, look, mix this up. One part gin, one part this lime juice, and you'll have a gimlet. And you can drink that. So they encourage them to drink their lime juice by adding alcohol back to it again by making it a cocktail.
Yeah. Well, that's like, it's you know, it made sense on a domestic, on a regular population market to have a non-alcoholic preserved lime juice. But as it applies to the British Navy, I don't think you were getting people to just sip on their lime juice without cutting it with some booze.
Hey, you expect me to drink this straight?
No. Oh, it's sweet now? That's fine. Give me some gin. Well, this is the same time period. This is when we get, like, you know, this is a bit of off topic, but like we get Navy strength gin. This is the time period it refers to because the British Navy, it's really, I mean, that's a whole other episode, but it's a funny story where they recognize, like, man, we got a lot of drunk sailors. We got to do something about the fact that all our sailors are drunk, but we can't give them less alcohol. That will result in mutiny. We just got to find a way to, like, make them drink it slower or dilute it or split it up through the day. They did every permutation. They would have, like, instead of one distribution in the morning, they do two distributions throughout the day. They tried to reduce the amount of alcohol they were giving them, like, proof it down, and then sailors started setting their booze on fire and be like, if it doesn't light on fire, it's not proper strength. You're screwing me over. So that's where the term Navy strength comes from. It's overproof because the Navy would set it on fire, and if it didn't burn, they'd threaten a mutiny. So, at least, you know, they but just that, want what they signed up for.
But the original gimlet, that's why the measurement on it you'd see would be 1-to-1.
Yeah.
Because they were trying to get you to drink more lime juice, not because they were trying to get you to drink more gin. But now, if you order a gimlet, you'll see it's either 2-to-1 gin to lime, or even in some cases 4-to-1 if you want it very dry, four parts gin to one part lime. So,
well, and part of that is also, you know, over time, we do recognize that our palate has kind of dried up over time. We don't like things quite as sweet as we used to. But it's set again against, like, also, I think, at least in the American market, the Roses lime on the market is a lot sweeter and a lot less complex. So you've got sweeter Roses lime. You've got a palate that likes things drier. So the proportions change. But in any case, the drink becomes popular. I mean, it starts being mentioned in the 1920s and 1930s. You know, recipes appear in print in, like, the 1923 Harry's ABC of Mixing Cocktails, of course, a very important cocktail manual. Also in the 1930s Savoy Cocktail Book. And both of these have that same recipe you mentioned, the equal parts, roses and gin, that's it. And it really gets into its heyday a few decades later in the 1950s. One of the sort of setting off points of this is the very popular Raymond Chandler novel, The Long Goodbye, which came out in 1953. Which, of course, you know, beloved detective series of, or starring Philip Marlowe, eventually a couple movies with Humphrey Bogart in them. I love him. But he talks about a gimlet specifically in that book and says it has to be half gin and half roses, lime juice, and nothing else. And then it beats the martini hollow, which becomes very popular. You know, also you have figures like who else, the Where's Waldo of drinking, Ernest Hemingway, writes about gimlets, loves gimlets, travels with a bottle of Gordon's and a bottle of roses wherever he goes so he can make gimlets wherever he is. And even kind of representing that time period, Mad Men chose to make the gimlet Betty Draper's drink of choice. So very popular in the 50s, the gimlet.
Yeah, you know, there's just certain drinks that, you know, they seem to be like the old-fashioned kind of drinks, you know, the martini and the gimlet and, you know, gin and tonic and stuff like that, that when you're a kid and you're starting to drink, you would never consider ordering something like that. That's a grown-up drink, you know. How do they like those things? Those are terrible.
Well, and they are usually, like, there are a lot of alcohol modified very simply, which, you know, fine, whatever that says. But I mean, in the 50s, like, the fact that the gimlet would become popular in this time period, I mean, that's we're talking, like, yeah, this is the heyday of the Manhattan, the martini, the gimlet. It's alcohol-forward, very simply modified drinks. And that simplicity, it kind of helps the drink survive in a real weird way. Like, the gimlet kind of lived through the dark ages of the American cocktail culture, like 70s and 80s, because it's so simple, because roses stuck around. Like, roses was domesticated enough that it didn't fall out of favor just because drinking culture fell out of favor, you know?
Well, I think that's one of the things I do like about it is the simplicity of it. Any kind of drink, you can just throw two things together, shake it up, and pour it out cold. That's a good drink.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I remember it being one of the first, and I mean, I'm like back in my early days, like in New York City and working in restaurants, that was one of the first cocktails, I guess, I was introduced to. And it was at a dive bar where, like, the chef that I worked with was like, oh, because I was like, I don't really, you know, I drink beer, drink wine, I don't really know a lot about either. He's like, oh, do you like cocktails? Drink a gimlet. And he ordered me a gimlet, and it was, we were at an absolute dive bar. There was no citrus, there was no nothing. It was Rose's Lime and Gordon's Gin. And that was my drink when I was about 2 years too young to be drinking alcohol legally in bars. But like that, and also at that point in New York, like, cocktail culture was not ubiquitous. Today, you can walk into a dive bar and not be surprised to see a cocktail menu. But, you know, in the early 2000s, late 90s, that was not the case. You had to go to a cocktail bar to get a cocktail. It was not everywhere. And the gimlet still survived all that. It stuck through. It lived through the... It was popular in the 50s. It hid underground in a bunker through the 60s and 70s and the 80s. And then, you know, when cocktail culture came back, it was there the whole time.
Well, I would think that even if you were a teenager and you walked up to a bar and ordered a gimlet, they'd say, oh, well, they must be old enough if they're ordering one of these.
That is, it is. Like, you have to know what you're drinking if you order a gimlet. But also, like, it is kind of, I mean, for the sweetness, it is very open. To a younger palate, to a less developed palate, and even with the changing proportions, it's still very sweet. But that's what, like, yeah, that's the interesting thing about the cocktail, because I feel like it was only with the real advent of, like, every bar being expected to have fresh juices, fresh syrups, which I don't think is a bad thing, but that's led to sort of the erasure of a proper gimlet. I can't think of, like, a nice cocktail bar that I've worked in the last decade that has had a bottle of limes behind the bar. If somebody were to gimlet, you were pouring them fresh lime juice and fresh simple syrup and gin. Or maybe vodka. The vodka gimlet really started off in popularity in the 50s, but it's kind of coexisted. Classic gimlet is gimlet. Classic gimlet is gin, but vodka's fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say if you were, you know, a mixologist, you would probably think you're doing the guy solid by actually mixing in lime juice and you know, simple syrup and stuff like that. When in fact, if you knew the history, you would know that a real gimlet has roses and gin.
Well, and that's, you know, some people will argue against that. Like, no, you know, this was what, it's better with fresh lime. It's better with fresh simple. And I don't think it's an art. It's not about what's better or worse. I think it ultimately just comes back to the preservation of the history of the drink.
Right.
And that's that I love, you know, the sour bill that is 2 ounces gin, 3/4 lime, 3/4 simple syrup. That's a gin sour to me. That's what that is. That's not a gimlet. Mm-hmm. A gimlet needs that little bit of viscosity that comes from the preserved lime. I mean, even like when you get into like sulfites, there's almost a salinity that comes into it. There's like a weird sort of savory flavor that comes into it. And also, when we're talking about preserved lime, like we don't know. I can't tell you how like industrial roses lime is made. But the original recipe, it involved the whole lime. So you get an element of the lime peel in there, which, you know, there's if you ever like muddled limes, like in a like a caipirinha, it imparts the lime oil. It imparts a bit of an herbal and earthy flavor to it when you deal with the peel of a citrus that you don't get from just the juice. So it's not a matter of what's better or worse. That's palate. That's subjective. That's not for none of us to declare. But the flavor profile of a classic gimlet is distinctly different from the flavor profile of a sour. And they're both fine. You just need to call the other one something else. A gin sour is a gin sour. A gin gimlet is a gin gimlet. They're not related.
Well, I think if you don't know, you tend to think that roses is just like a fake lime, imitation lime syrup of some type. Yeah. But it's not. It's actually made from limes. It just goes through a preserving process that adds that viscosity and the sugar to it. But it is actually made from lime. So you are getting real lime juice in it.
Well, and I think, you know, if you want to be like, if you want to be that bar program and you want to make gimlets like the real way, you can make preserved lime. It's not that hard to make. You know, you start with like an oleosacrum where you're going to, oleosacrum is where you take your citrus peel and the oils from that citrus peel and like let the sugar extract those oils and kind of make a syrup from that. And then you add your juice to it. And that's the old process. We don't know what roses lime is doing now, but that's the original process for making that cordial, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you would have made a lemon or lime cordial back in the day and extract those oils from the peel. I think that's cool. If you want to do that, if you want to make a real preserved lime juice, something that's a shelf-stable lime juice that you make in-house, cool. I love that idea. But it's not made better with the fresh juice and the fresh simple. It's just made different.
Hear, hear.
Again, in the words of Philip Marlowe, a real gimlet is half gin and half roses lime juice and nothing else.
That's right. Martini Hollow. And Philip Marlowe wouldn't lie to you.
Well, he probably would if he was trying to solve a crime. But hey, there you go. And again, you know, I brought this to the table because also if you're a non-drinker, you can get a bottle of roses, sweet, and lime and, you know, make some delicious mocktails with it. And there's no alcohol in it. It has, its history is based in a non-alcohol option of a traditionally alcoholic ingredient.
And there's a vodka version of it if you want. It's the exact same mix, but not with vodka instead of gin. And, you know, there's some people that don't like gin. And so you can go that version. And there's ones that would argue with you which is better, but that's a personal preference.
Well, again, it's palate. And if your drink of choice is a gimlet, but you like your gimlet made with simple and fresh lime, I'm not going to tell you can't call that a gimlet. But I historically, I think the history of the gimlet's really cool. The history of roses is really cool. It's a bit of medical history. It's a bit of naval history. It's a bit of, you know, British history. It's kind of fascinating. So, you know, try it out, you know. And I do see a lot of people that kind of make the caveat of like, no, you got to have roses in there, but you also need some fresh acid or some fresh citrus in there. And they'll make a gimlet with roses and some fresh lime or even like some lime peel. And that's what they'll do to make their fresh gimlet. And that's cool. Like, you can play around with the idea, but don't knock it. Don't assume you're better than roses, sweet, and lime. I think it's a necessary bar ingredient.
You can just, you know, put a lime on the side of the glass. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Anyway, there's some history for the gimlet and for roses, sweet, and lime. You know, if you're already a fan, you didn't need to hear any of this. Good for you. But thank you for being here. Thank you, Dad.
Well, thank you, Tay, for having me. I always learn something. And you know, when you brought that up and I saw the bottle, I said, I've seen that. We've got that. Why do we have that? How do I have something this fancy?
Well, and is it fancy? I don't know. Is it like historically important? Absolutely. And it's very cool and it's very cheap. Thank you all for joining us. If you want to find us on the internet, we are Neat the Boozcast on Instagram. We are neattheboozcast@gmail.com if you want to email us any questions, any thoughts. We have a Patreon. If you want to join that, you get the rewards, videos, all sorts of fun stuff. And if you want to talk about, I don't know, your opinions on the Gimlet, we have a place you can do that.
At Meet the Boozcast group page on Facebook.
Go there, do that. All right. Well, thanks again. I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
Meet. It's amazing that our military had to have their alcohol to keep fighting.
It's actually kind of an upsetting study when you look at how many wars most of the military was drunk through. You realize that was just a big part of it.
Alcohol and weapons, they mix.
Lots of people are drunk. Yeah. Well, how else are you going to convince somebody to do that? Like, you know.
Charge! Give me a drink first!
Yeah.